Hi, I'm Michael Panish, and welcome to the Clark Reaper podcast at clarkreaper.com. If you have any comments or questions about Clark Reaper, send me an email at m.panish@comcast.net. That's Panish spelled P-A-N-U-S-H. Today's story is The Showdown at Roswell, the second chapter in Clark Reaper Tales. I do hope you enjoy it. And now, The Showdown at Roswell. Clark Reaper and the Showdown at Roswell. Now, I've seen my share of strange things. After I had rode a dead horse out of a city filled with walking corpses who wanted nothing more than a snack on me, I figured I had seen all there was to see. I couldn't have been more wrong. You see, my name's Clark Reaper, and I'm a bounty hunter. It's my business to deal with strange things, and one of the strangest had just happened in the little town of Roswell, New Mexico. The town had been founded a while back in 1871, a little settlement surrounded by a desert that no one would think twice about. But lately, some mighty odd events had made Roswell the center of the nation's attention. First of all, a couple of farmers began losing their cows. One of the farmers said he had spotted a big metal disc flying in the sky, and that it grabbed his cow in a kind of green light and flew away with it. Most of the normal people in Roswell figured he had been hitting the bottle a bit too hard. Events got stranger, and one of those flying discs, supposedly one as big as a mountain, crashed into the desert outside of Roswell. The townsfolk sent out a few men to look at it, but they didn't come back. It didn't take long for the army to get wind of what was going on and evacuate the whole town. According to the papers, Roswell was now just a ghost town with a giant flying metal disc lying smashed somewhere on the outskirts. I had a good feeling that my services would soon be needed, so there I was, sitting on a train headed for Santa Fe, with McColt peacemakers and the holsters at my waist, and God only knows how many other guns tucked away in my baggage. Soon as I got off the train in Santa Fe, I received a letter delivered to me by a Union Telegram boy. It was asking me to meet a client in the fanciest hotel in Santa Fe in 2 hours. I gotta take any job I can get these days, as I sure do need the money. You see, when I was fighting those living dead way up in Kansas, I found myself looking after a curly-haired little boy by the name of Charles Green. Poor little feller's father had been gobbled up by those dead folks, and I decided that since I was the only person he had in the whole world, I ought to look after him. When I got the telegram, Charles was sitting on a bench in the train station next to my luggage, his legs idly kicking in the air. He was small for his age, had curly brown hair, freckles, and was dressed in a little suit and peak cap. With my weathered face, crumbling Stetson, and dirty tan duster, we could have come from different worlds, just like what some people were saying about the flying disc that had crashed in Roswell. "Well, will you look at this," I said, sitting down next to Charles and showing him the papers. Charles was working on a math problem in a composition book. On account of I figured a boy should learn his reading and his ciphering, Charles had taken up the book without complaint. "What are those?" Charles asked, closing the composition book. "I got this here letter asking for my help, and would you believe who sent it?" "Who?" the little feller asked curiously. "P.T. Barnum," I said, not quite believing that the great Eastern showman had dragged himself all the way out here, or that he was asking for my help. "You know, P.T. Barnum, of Barnum's Grand Traveling Museum, Menagerie, Caravan, and Circus." Charles perked up. "Wow! My father always talked about taking me to see one of his shows, but..." He drifted off and fell silent. Poor kid. I put a hand on his shoulder. "Well, now we're going to see the man himself. Come on, I don't want to keep him waiting." I checked our luggage in a place in the train station and followed the directions of the letter. It didn't say what he wanted me for, but I could figure it out easily enough. The hotel was near the train station, so Charles and I didn't have to walk that far. I kept my coat open so passerby could see the shiny Colts in my holsters. Santa Fe is a tough town, and I didn't want no two-bit thug to try and rob me or put Charles at any risk. When we reached the hotel, I was surprised to see a large number of men I recognized standing around the lobby. There was Werner von Humboldt, wearing a blue uniform and a pointy pickle-hob helmet. He was the Prussian sharpshooter who had come out to America looking for work and found it in killing. Trapper Jack was there, dressed in a fringed deerskin jacket and fur cap. He was a noted mountain man and slayer of the famed beast of Bray Road. Rounding out the crowd was Hugo Montez. The wild Mexican bladesman was sporting a torn sombrero and a dusty poncho. He was the only man to have braved the numerous booby traps in the fabled Montezuma's fortress and survived. I nodded to all of them as I walked in, not having a quarrel with anybody. But as I was heading to some seats in the back of the lobby, I spotted a cluster of people that made me stop dead in my tracks. Charles saw my surprise and stopped too. He pointed at the strange group of individuals, one of them as small as a desert mouse, another as big as a building from a back east city. "Who are they?" he asked. "Friends of yours?" "Nope," I said, anger sneaking into my voice. I went for my guns, and when the group of strange folks saw me, they went for their guns too, until we had a Mexican standoff going. This was the notorious Sideshow Gang, former circus freaks, and now the terror of the West. I had been paid considerable sums of money to kill them, and we had a running feud that made the Hatfields and the McCoys look like peaceful neighbors. We stood there, looking at each other, still as statues. "Howdy, Sideshows," I said. "Still got the same number of freaks?" "You better believe it, Buster!" shouted a squeaky voice about an inch above the floor. It belonged to Little Napoleon, a midget dressed in a dark suit and a stovepipe hat about three times as big as he was. Standing behind him was the Sideshow Gang's strong man, Pantagruel Johnson. The massive giant had twirled mustachios and was covered in muscles from head to toe. A long-barreled revolver looked small in his huge hands, while Little Napoleon's derringer looked huge. Behind them were Jacob Half and Nick Half, a pair of Siamese twins known as the Half and Half Bros. Each one of them had a sawed-off shotgun aimed at me. Standing near them was Beardita, an overweight bearded lady in a tight dress, armed with a Springfield, and sitting on the floor next to her was Armless Hans, whose lack of arms didn't prevent him from aiming a Colt at me with his feet. The final member of the gang and the ringmaster of their little circus was Mr. Adagio, a lithe gent with a curled black mustache decked out in a crimson tuxedo. "I can't help but notice," Adagio said as he leveled a revolver at me, "that we have you outgunned." "That depends on what you mean by being outgunned," I said, keeping my hands steady on the triggers of my pistols. "I can still blast to you before your bullets bring me down. Y'all wonder which two it's going to be?" "That may be so," Mr. Adagio spat back, "but your midget assistant will also perish in the gunfire." I looked at Charles. He looked very small and thin, like I could pick him up and put him in my pocket if I wanted to. I knew we couldn't both get through a gunfight alive. I holstered my Colts. "I don't want no trouble," I said. "Just let me hear P.T. Barnum's proposition, and I'll be on my way." "Don't want trouble, eh?" Little Napoleon said, stepping forward. The little guy was easily the most aggressive of the whole Sideshow Gang. "Well, listen here, bub, we are looking for trouble. You're gonna get it, and so is that stinking midget you have licking your boot heels." "I'm not a midget," Charles said. "I'm only 9. I'll be 10 in a few months." "Is that a fact?" Little Napoleon snarled. Then the devilish dwarf's insults were interrupted when P.T. Barnum himself marched into the lobby. The master showman was dressed in a striking black cape and three-piece suit, with a black top hat set jauntily on his head. His red face was clean-shaven, and his straight black hair reminded me of a scraggly tumbleweed. Barnum was followed by a trio of assistants, nervous-looking young men in their shirt sleeves, who had to turn him around and point him in the right direction, as well as straightening his tie and adjusting his cap. "Ladies and gentlemen," Barnum shouted out in a booming voice, "children of all ages, you are about to witness the greatest!" One of his assistants leaned over and whispered into his ear, and Barnum suddenly stopped shouting like he was opening one of his shows. "Oh, excuse me. I always forget what I'm not supposed to be performing. Light me a cigar, will ya?" he ordered his assistant as he plopped unceremoniously down in a nearby chair. The assistant lit and placed a large cigar in Barnum's mouth, and the circus owner turned to the collection of bounty hunters and ruffians he had assembled in the hotel lobby. "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you all know what happened in the town of Roswell recently, and have heard rumors about what exactly fell out of the sky. Some of my advisors have told me that the metal disc contains the bodies, or body, of creatures from another world. We all gasped. P.T. Barnum smiled at his audience and continued, "That's right, Martians! They're here, they're real, and I want one. I will pay 4,000 United States dollars for a dead one, and 6,000 for each living specimen. The Martian will be put on display at my circus, and every American who coughs up a nickel can gaze at its alien strangeness." We all stared at him. That was the kind of money you could live off of for the rest of your life. Putting down my cults for good and spending my life in a comfortable cabin somewhere was starting to sound mighty good to me. After all, I wasn't getting any younger, and I could give Charles the childhood he deserved. "Now, whoever brings the Martian back first gets the money," Barnum said. "Let the race begin!" Well, we all bolted after that. Time was ticking, and I knew that every second I wasn't looking for that Martian was counting against me, especially with folks like Hugo Montez and Trapper Jack on the trail. As for the sideshow gang, they didn't give Charles or me a second look as they dashed out of the hotel. Not having a horse or very many supplies, I hightailed it to the local stables to procure us some transport. Charles tagged along, and as I was checking the teeth of horses to find the best one, I noticed the boy looked kind of forlorn. "What's eating you, son?" I asked. "Don't you want to find the Martians P.T. Barnum was talking about?" "I guess so," Charles said, looking down at the floor. "It just seems kind of cruel to capture the Martian and have him be sent to a circus. I mean, people will just stare at him all day, and he won't get to go home to Mars." Charles trailed off. "It just seems mean." "Aw, hell," I said comfortingly. "Martians ain't got no feelings. They're probably just like big rocks or big brains or something." "Really?" A strangely cool, almost metallic voice came from my side. I spun around and saw a feller all dressed up like an undertaker. He had a black top hat, black suit, black tie, black gloves, and smoked glasses resting on his thin nose. His appearance seemed kind of unearthly, and I noticed he was standing next to a horse that was as black as his clothes. "Are you an expert on the creatures that fell from the sky, then?" "No, sir," I said, a bit taken aback by this mysterious feller. "Just got myself an assignment from P.T. Barnum to capture one of them, is all. I reckon I can do it." "Are you potent with those pistols?" the undertaker asked. "I see 6 guns on everyone in this day and age. Some people know how to use them, most don't." "I'm a good shot," I said. "Wouldn't last long in my line of work if I weren't." "Why are you asking so many questions, anyway? Is P.T. Barnum paying you money to go capture the Martians, too?" "First of all, they might not be from Mars," the man in black said calmly. "Secondly, I serve a far higher authority than any trumped-up ringmaster. The United States federal government, to be exact. And if anybody gets in our way, I'll be glad to have them executed for treason." "I didn't mean no harm," I started to say, but the undertaker turned around and led his horse out of the stable without giving me a second look. I turned to Charles and shrugged. "You think a crazy feller like that could be a federal agent?" Charles shrugged. After I had purchased a good Palomino mare, I went to the general store and got 2 bedrolls, enough food to last us for 5 days, enough water for 10, a couple more rounds of ammunition, and a bunch of bear traps. I figured that no matter how many arms or legs the Martians had, one of them would get stuck in the iron jaws of the trap. With all of that packed up in my horse's bulging saddlebags, and little Charles seated on the back of the horse with his arms around my waist, we set out. For the first day, we didn't see nothing but the rising sun, the empty stretch of desert, and an occasional cactus. New Mexico is a pretty barren part of the country, and sometimes there weren't even a patch of grass taking up the space between the sky and the ground. I drank a lot of water, and I urged Charles to drink even more. Being so full of liquid that it sloshed inside of you whenever the horse bucked wasn't no fun, but getting dehydrated out in the deep desert was even worse. It wasn't until late in the evening, when the sun went down and a moon that looked 3 sizes too big peeked out of the darkness, that we saw a sign of life. Way out near a rocky outcropping was a little fire, but I couldn't see a soul around it. Kinda confused, I urged the horse towards the fire. Charles had fallen asleep in the saddle, and his regular breathing was comforting in the night. As I got closer to the fire, I heard someone shouting, begging for help in what sounded like Spanish. I spurred my horse to a light trot and cut my hand to my ear. "Ayuda! Ayuda!" someone cried. It sounded like Hugo Montes. I didn't speak much Espanol, but I had spent enough time south of the border to know he needed help. I turned my horse's trot into a gallop until I reached the outcropping. Sure enough, Hugo Montes was hog-tied and lying on the ground next to the crackling fire. Looked like there had been a real scrap around his campsite, too, with a collapsed tent, a couple of spent shells lying on the ground, and a long-bladed Mexican machete jabbed into the dirt. "Hugo," I said, stopping the horse next to me. "¿Qué pasa?" When he saw me, he gulped and wouldn't meet my gaze. "Oh, Clark Reaper," he said. "Lo siento. Los ejemplares anormales. They snuck up on me, tied me up, made me yell. I am very sorry." "Ejemplares anormales?" I said, mashing up the Spanish words with my bad accent. "In English," the nasally voice of Little Napoleon said from behind me, "freaks." I turned around and saw the entire sideshow gang aiming their weapons at me. They stepped out from behind the rocky outcropping where they had been hiding, after they had been using poor Hugo for bait. Now I was trapped. "Well, well, well," Mr. Adagio said in a soothing voice as he walked next to me. "If it isn't Clark Reaper, with his pistol so very far from his hands." "That can change real fast," I said, but didn't make no move. "Perhaps," Mr. Adagio said. He nodded to the sideshow's strong man. "Pantagruel, kindly disarm Mr. Reaper." The muscled brute stepped forward, twirled his mustache, and lifted me off of my horse with one hand. The half-and-half bros stepped forward, relieving me of my pistols. "I'll take that," they said in unison. I was getting a little bit upset, not for myself, of course, as I had been in several worse scrapes than this, but for Charles in the saddle. "Y'all can beat up on me as much as you want," I told Mr. Adagio, "but I'm going to have to ask you not to hurt the boy. He didn't do no one any harm." Mr. Adagio merely smiled. "Quite the contrary," he said, leaping next to me with a practiced somersault. "Doing harm to him will do harm to you." He pulled a thin stiletto knife out of his jacket. I felt my heart stop beating as he approached Charles. I'd save the boy from flesh-eaten walking corpses, and I didn't want to see him done in with a letter opener. Charles awoke as Mr. Adagio leered over him. The aggressive acrobat seemed a bit surprised, but he wasted no time in pulling Charles off the horse and putting the blade to his throat. "Mr. Reaper?" Charles asked, his voice high and nervous. "What's going on?" "If you touch a hair on that boy's head, I swear on my own soul I will kill you in ways that would make a murderous Comanche look like a saint." I snarled at Mr. Adagio as my throat went cold. I took a step forward. Little Napoleon ran over to block me, but I kicked the midget backwards and stepped over him. To my horror, I realized I wasn't going to be fast enough to save Charles. The grin in Mr. Adagio was already bringing down the knife. A shot rang out, and a single bullet shattered the stiletto. Mr. Adagio violently shoved Charles to the ground and gracefully flipped backwards. For a single second, everything was silent except for the chirching crickets and Charles's nervous teeth chattering. I took a step towards Charles. "Nobody move or I shoot!" A bass voice called out from a nearby cactus. But it weren't no cactus. It was Trapper Jack, wearing a strange green spiky outfit that disguised him real good. He was armed with the biggest muzzle-loading rifle I had ever seen. It was as big as a cannon, and had a muzzle that looked like an endless black tunnel you could get lost in. "Trapper Jack!" I exclaimed. You surprised me." "That's what I do," the mountain man said gruffly, shaking off his costume. "Now let's all drop our guns and lie down like good boys and girls. I'll tie you up like the Mexican and get the Martians for myself." "What about the Prussian?" Birdita asked in a voice a little deeper than Trapper Jack's. "He still hasn't shown up." "Let the Kraut come," Trapper Jack said haughtily. "I can take him." As if on cue, a shot rang out and blasted the trapper's hand cannon from his hands. Werner von Humboldt galloped in on a large Clydesdale, a scoped rifle held in his hands. "Foolish American," he said with his strong German accent, "you cannot outwit the favorite son of Prussia. Are you willing to test your weak American reflexes against the height of Teutonic breeding?" Before anyone could answer, we all heard a great whooshing noise, and something very large, very silver, and very fast zoomed over our heads. It fluttered the tent and blew out the campfire. I'm still not sure what exactly happened after that. All sorts of guns seemed to go off. Pantagruel picked up a rock and threw it at Trapper Jack, who smashed the strong man on the head with his rifle. Humboldt was thrown from his horse, which I think was trampling Little Napoleon, and Hugo Montes managed to free himself and jumped into the fray with his machete. I punched and kicked, giving a good account of myself, all while waiting for my eyes to adjust so I could find Charles, who was still on the ground somewhere. I managed to punch out the half-and-half brothers and retrieve McColt's. Then, through the dust, I spotted Charles. He had crawled to the very edge of the outcropping and was covering his ears. I noticed armless Hans tiptoeing towards the boar on one foot, a bowie knife clutched in the other. My heart stopped beating again. Suddenly, the whooshing silver disc came back, but this time it hovered above the outcropping and was still. Everyone stopped fighting and stared at it. The first thing I noticed was how reflective it was. Looking into it was like staring at a circular mirror. It was about the size of a large carriage, and had a small bulge on the top that seemed to be made of darkened glass. "What in the holy," I started to say, but then things got even stranger. The hovering disc got a bit lower, and the bottom part of it opened up. A strange green light flared out, focusing on Charles. He was completely bathed in it, and he stood up and opened his eyes. "Mr. Reaper," he gasped, "what's happening?" "I don't rightly know, son," I shouted, "but I aim to find out. Just stay still and don't go anywhere." But I can't help it," Charles said, and he was right. Before my eyes, the boar seemed to lift into the air. He was heading for the opening in the flying disc. I ran over and jumped, grabbing onto his legs, but the light was too strong, pulling me about a foot into the air before my grip loosened and I fell down. All I could do was watch as Charles disappeared into the middle of the flying disc, just as the fight started up again. The disc started slowly to move away, but I figured I might catch it if I was fast enough. I ran through the battling group of circus freaks and gunmen and leapt onto my horse. I dug in both spurs and galloped after the flying disc. I had been in chases before, but this one was probably the most one-sided. The disc cut effortlessly through the air, and it was all my poor horse could do to keep up with it. Then the disc hovered lower and lower, closer and closer to the ground. I spurred the horse on, hoping to get close enough to stop it somehow. There was nothing ahead of us but flat ground, so I figured I could stop checking where I was going and start shooting. I stood up in the saddle and drew out both my pistols, aimed them at the flying disc, and fired. I might as well have not bothered. The bullets just pinged off of its reflective sides without leaving a hint of a mark. "Why don't you stop flying and fight me?" I shouted at the flying disc. It flew a little bit ahead of me, stopped, and turned around. I began to wish I hadn't yelled at it. "Son of a gun," I muttered as the flying disc dived closer and closer to the ground and zoomed straight towards me, its mirrored sides looking hard as diamonds. "Son of a gun!" I stood up on the horse and, without thinking, jumped. I landed right on top of the flying disc. The disc went off faster than a bullet from a gun. I hung on to the sides, but I could feel myself slowly slipping off, ripped apart by the crushing wind. I pulled my bowie knife from my boot and slammed it into the hovering disc. That knife might have cut through bone with ease, but it became as flimsy as uncooked bacon soon as it touched the surface of the speeding saucer. After that, I don't remember too much. I guess the wind got to me, because I slid backwards faster and faster until the hovering disc seemed to have passed me up completely, and I fell off. I hit the ground screaming like all hell, and after that, I didn't see much more for a while. When I woke up, I found myself looking into the face of a nightmare. A feller with pale, pasty skin, dressed all in black, with a pair of smoked glasses over his eyes, leered at me. It took me a while to realize it was the Undertaker from the stables, or someone dressed just like him. "I see you're awake," the Undertaker said. I sat up, even though it seemed like some miners were blasting off dynamite in my head. "You know," the Undertaker said. You are the only gun-toting rogue to make it this far towards Roswell. I feel I must congratulate you. Where the hell is my boy? I said. We were in some kind of a tent made of a black material that made it look like it was still dark outside. The Undertaker shook his head sadly. You seem so promising, and yet you seem to have the same feelings as every other sap and sucker out here. You are going to make history today, Clark Reaper, and all you can think about is your pathetic offspring, who is not even your own. Now see here, I said, coming to my feet. Despite my aching body, I found myself getting angry. Charles is a good boy, and I'm the one looking out for him. I don't want any stinking Martians taking him back to Mars or wherever they came from. Then perhaps you shouldn't have made this journey, the Undertaker shot back, still keeping his tone of low malevolence. Come outside, Clark Reaper, and see what glorious events will soon transpire. I followed him out of the tent and into the blazing New Mexico sun. I gasped at what I saw. The Undertakers, and there are a hell of a lot of them, had set up camp, and they hadn't wasted any time doing it. Black tents stood in rows, and a large number of black carriages pulled by black horses stood at the ready. But the strangest part was the whole mess of black hot air balloons with black baskets hanging from them filling up the sky. Each one had an odd insignia on the gas bag, a pyramid with an eye in the middle. Quite impressive, isn't it, Clark Reaper? The Undertaker next to me said. A number of other men in identical dress joined us in the center of the camp. How do you know my name? I whispered. We've read your file, Clark Reaper. We know all about you. I couldn't help gulping. My hands went to my peacemakers, and I was pleased to see they were still there. But then I realized if the Undertakers let me keep my weapons, they must not be afraid of them. What government do you black-covered folk work for? I asked. The United States, the Kaiser, the Tsar, the Mikado of Japan, or perhaps our own. After today, we shall decide what government serves us. I felt a little weak in the knees. My whole body still felt like jellied pig's feet from the fall, and just as I began to feel really sick, a familiar whooshing sound filled the air. They are coming! The Undertaker suddenly shouted. Clark Reaper, help us destroy them, and we may let you and your offspring survive the day. We have made sorties against them, and now they try to test us! The Undertaker was right. Four of them flying silver discs were headed straight for the camp, and a whole bunch of strange-looking creatures were flying next to them. They had bulbous heads, spindly bodies, and huge black eyes that didn't look like anything found on Earth. They wore silver suits that glimmered just like the hovering discs, and they had on backpacks with tiny rockets that kept them in the air. But what worried me was the strange-looking pistols with pie plates stuck on the end that they all carried. Martians! I shouted. Honest to God, Martians! To your guns, Clark Reaper! The Undertaker ordered me. The enemy draws nearer! What about you guys? I said, dropping to my knee and drawing out my peacemakers with a spin. You got any shooting irons? The man in black laughed without humor. You have no idea. He reached into his coat and drew out a Gatling gun, only small enough to fit in his hands, and began working the crank while holding on to the trigger. All the other Undertakers drew out either handheld Gatlings or long-barreled silver pepper-box pistols that seemed to fire explosive bullets. The flying discs got closer, and the battle was on. Now, I'm not a stranger to conflict, having fought on both sides of the Civil War, and being a veteran of countless shootouts and gunfights, but this was like nothing I had ever seen. The flying disc shot out huge blasts of red light that burned my eyes if I just looked at them. The red beam set fire to the black tents, and when it passed over an Undertaker, it fried him up, just like a magnifying glass to a bug. The little Martians shot smaller red lights out of their pie plate guns, and they burned holes straight through some of the unlucky Undertakers. But the men in the black clothes fought back hard. The tops of the carriages opened up, and a swarm of rockets flew out of them, crashing into the flying discs. The black hot air balloons blazed away with miniature cannons and rockets, too, and one by one, the flying discs became blackened and burnt. One of them exploded in the sky and was nothing more than dust, and another sunk lower and lower until it stopped moving and smoldered in the dirt. I blazed away at the flying Martians, but my bullets all seemed to fall short. The Undertaker next to me worked the crank of his handheld Gatling gun fast as lightning and tore the oncoming Martians apart. and the strange pepperbox pistol seemed to blow flying Martians into tiny pieces. One of the hovering creatures came straight for me, but I brought up both my peacemakers and shot it twice in his bulbous head. It let out a screech, bled blue blood, and collapsed to the ground. I reckon that Samuel Colt made men and Martians equal. After the battle was over and all the flying discs lay burning on the ground, I walked over to them to see if I could find any trace of Charles Green. The Undertakers were stripping apart the crashed silver disc like vultures eating up a corpse, but there weren't nothing in the first two I looked at. But then I heard a high-pitched voice piping out my name, and I felt my heart beating back to normal. Charles Green had crawled out of the smoking wreckage, and didn't look no worse for wear, if a bit scared. He ran towards me across the dusty desert, and we embraced. "Mr. Reaper," he said, after he had calmed down a bit, "the Martians, why are you shooting at them?" "I don't rightly know. The Undertakers, the men in the black suits, they were shooting at 'em." "But the Martians are nice," Charles said, and I could hear the conviction in his voice. "They saved me from that guy with the feet, and they talked to me, or, well, thought to me in the flying ship, and they're not even from Mars, and—" "Slow down, son," I said. "What exactly happened on that flying ship?" "Well, it was very bright, and there were a bunch of those big-headed beings in there." A small group of the Undertakers had silently surrounded us. Charles didn't seem to notice and continued. "They thought to me, talking without moving their lips. I could hear their voices in my mind." "What did they say?" I asked curiously. "They told me they came from a planet far away, not even in the same universe as Earth. They are on a research mission to find out what kind of life was living here. They never wanted to hurt anybody, but then their mothership, that's the big one, crashed outside of Roswell, and they had to wait to repair it. Some people from Roswell came and tried to attack them, and they defended themselves, and the people got killed." "They don't seem to have much qualms about blowing up folks," I said. "You sure they're nice?" "Well, not nice. They think humans are like animals. Lower life form is how they referred to me. But they want to research us, not to hurt us. Then they found out that these men in the black clothes were trying to capture them, so they flew out to talk to them, and I went along, and you guys shot at us." One of the Undertakers, looking identical to all of his brothers, stepped forward and put a hand on each of our shoulders. "We just received a telepathic communication from the mothership," he said coldly. "They want to meet with us to discuss things. They are sending an emissary, and we will meet with them in the abandoned town of Roswell." "Well, that don't sound too bad," I said. "You can apologize to them, they can apologize to us, they can repair the ship, and we can all go home happy." "That's not the way it's going to be, Clark Reaper." His grip on my shoulder seemed to tighten. "They have requested you as our emissary, because your child told them good things about you. They trust you, and that will give us the opportunity to strike." "How do you figure?" I said, not liking at all where this was headed. "You will shoot the alien emissary, and we will be in the buildings of the abandoned town, ready to ambush them. The aliens will be overwhelmed and destroyed. Then we will go and capture their main ship. All the technology will be ours." "Don't do it!" Charles cried, but then the Undertaker tightened his grip and made Charles cry out in pain. "Son, I don't reckon I have much of a choice, not if we want to keep on breathing." I came to my feet, straightened up as best I could, and with my body still aching, I went out to meet the Martians, or whoever they were, and have a showdown at Roswell. Roswell had been abandoned long enough to look like a ghost town. It had one main street and only a few two-story buildings. Some of the glass had been shattered in the windows, but other than that, there weren't no sign of disturbance. Some of the rocking chairs on the porches of the abandoned houses even rocked eerily in the light wind that blew through the town. The Undertakers scurried into the buildings, doing their best to hide themselves. Though they told me they would pop out and save me before the alien emissaries fried me up like Kentucky chicken, I had a feeling that the only way for me to survive this showdown at Roswell was for me to keep a firm grip on my peacemakers. Poor Charles was rudely grabbed by an Undertaker and taken to the roof of Roswell's general store, where I could see the outline of a man in black clothes behind him. The meaning was clear. If I messed up, Charles would pay. The main street of Roswell was completely empty, except for me on one end and a group of those short, big-headed aliens on the other. The low wind running through the abandoned town made my duster flutter, and the alien's silver clothes shimmer. Slowly, we approached each other. One of the aliens walked in front of his friends, and I figured him for the leader. He was a bit taller than all the other big heads, and he had two pie-plate guns and a slim metal belt around his waist. We faced each other. The wind blew again, and a thin stream of dust floated into the air. My hand stood inches above my Colt's, my legs spread out, my eyes narrowed. The alien rested one hand on the top of one of his pie-plate pistols. His giant black eyes were fixed on me. It was clear what was going to happen next. Then I turned my head and spotted Charles standing up on top of the general store. His story about the aliens being just explorers whose ship had crashed sounded right. They didn't mean anyone no harm, unlike the black-clad men who had attacked them. If I killed those aliens, Charles would be heartbroken. But if I didn't, then the Undertakers would break more than his heart. There's nothing for me to do but shoot the big-headed feller in front of me and hope for the best. Unless... I looked up at the Undertaker standing behind Charles again and narrowed my eyes. It was a crazy shot, and an impossible angle. And yet if I made the shot, I would have to survive the Undertaker's volley. But I was going to do it. Wait, something in my brain said, like someone was talking to me. But no one's lips were moving. Instead, the big-headed alien was thinking to me, just as Charles had said. The voice in my head continued, "If you move against us, you will be terminated. You are fascinating specimens. We have already lost too many researchers on this world." "I ain't got no quarrel with you," I whispered, every aching muscle in my body prepping for what I was about to do. "Just follow my lead." I leapt backwards, spinning my body around in air as my hands went for my peacemakers. The Undertaker behind Charles made an O with his mouth before I blasted him straight in the forehead. The man in the black clothes wavered, and then his smoked glasses fell off and I looked at his eyes. They were segmented and red and certainly not human. I had about half a second to leap for cover before handheld Gatling gun fire and explosive pepper box rounds filled the air. I ducked behind a bunch of barrels, blasting at the Undertakers who were taking cover behind the windows of Roswell's only hotel. I shot one of them and he shattered the window as he fell. I dodged across the street and headed for the general store, where the bastards in black had taken Charles. The aliens were holding their own, too, but instead of taking cover, they stood in the street and simply fired away with their pie-plate guns. Loads of bullets were fired at them, but the aliens were protected by some sort of shimmering shield that appeared to protect their bodies. I found myself glad that I hadn't tried to shoot it out with the big-headed creatures. The Undertakers were waiting for me when I kicked down the door of the general store. A pepper box round crashed into my shoulder and nearly knocked me over with its small explosion. I gritted my teeth with pain, then fanned out my revolver and blasted all the Undertakers in there. Before their bodies had even hit the ground, I was running to the roof. When I got there, I saw Charles cowering on the ground, scared as hell and covered with some of the Undertaker's blood, but alive and unhurt. I kneeled down next to him. "I guess you were right about the big-headed folk," I said, helping Charles to his feet. "Why didn't they set up one of them shields when we were fighting them earlier?" I wondered. "Maybe they needed time to set it up," Charles suggested. "They were here for a while, so maybe they created the shield." "Well, we'd best get the hell out of this town before the Undertakers or the aliens bring in the big guns." "Oh, no," Charles said, pointing behind me. "They already have." I turned and saw an ominous sight. The black hot air balloons were heading straight towards Roswell, and they were bristling with cannons and rockets. "Son of a gun," I shouted, "we better get in the storm cellar and hide this one out." Just then, an Undertaker charged up the stairs at us. Before he could begin cranking his handheld Gatling gun, I blasted him in the chest and watched him sink down the stairs. His smoke glasses fell off, and I got another look at segmented red eyes. "Who are these people?" Charles asked. "Are they also from another planet?" "Could be," I said. "Could be they come from holes in the ground. But we'll never get a chance to find out if we don't get out of here." As I was heading down the stairs, a strange noise made me stop. A tinkling horn played a circus band's tune. I perked my head up, stared off into the distance, and saw the strangest-looking vehicle I had ever seen. Something like a train car mixed with a tricycle, being driven by a man with no arms. The Sideshow Gang had arrived. The cart plowed into Main Street, and I could see not only the entire Sideshow Gang riding in it, but also Trapper Jack, Hugo Montez, and Werner von Humboldt. I figured they must have made some kind of deal to get to Roswell as fast as possible. Suddenly, an idea gripped me. "Hey, freaks," I shouted, "you feel like giving me a hand here?" "You?"
Little Napoleon yelled. I thought the flying saucer splattered you. Well, I'll be glad to do the splattering myself.
Hold, Mr. Adagio said, restraining the sideshow's most angry and diminutive member. Reaper, who are all these people dressed in black?
They want the fortune from capturing the aliens. Martians, I mean, I said with a smile. Looks like they might just get it, too.
Things like that have a way of changing, Mr. Adagio said. He turned to his menagerie as he drew a Remington shotgun out of the cart.
Freaks, let's put on a show!
The sideshow gang sprang into action, and the three gunmen along for the ride joined in.
An undertaker, Limlons, kicked one of them into a water trough and drowned him with his feet. And Mr. Adagio spun around like a top, spitting out bullets everywhere. And the balloons? Well, those black-painted flying machines didn't cause too much trouble. Rapper Jack aimed his giant hunting rifle and fired a nine-pins ball that blew one of the hot air balloons in two. Werner von Humboldt whipped out a shot with his sniper rifle that set off the ammo on one of the other balloons, and Hugo Montez climbed to the roof of a building, leapt into the basket of an oncoming balloon, and gutted every undertaker inside with his machetes. With the aliens still blazing away from behind their invisible shields, the sideshow gang and their friends shooting everything up, and yours truly blasting the occasional undertaker with his peacemakers, the battle didn't go on for much longer. The men in black fought a running retreat through the town, and then piled into their black carriages. Some of the sideshow gang wanted to run after them, but Mr. Adagio said that we had won, and I believed him. With the dead undertakers still draining their blood in the street, I figured it would be a good time to leave, but the aliens had other ideas. A nagging feeling made me walk over to where the big-headed ambassador and his friends were still standing around, with a small hill of bullets in front of them. Howdy, I said. So, I reckon y'all be heading back home, right? We can part as friends, or at least not as enemies, right?
Perhaps, the big head thought, and I heard him loud and clear in my mind. But we still have not fulfilled our mission.
And what would that be, I asked, not liking the sound of what the alien was thinking.
We need specimens to bring back home, to display for our people, and to do research on. Then we can plan further action or inaction for the planet. We need specimens.
What exactly did you have in mind? I asked. Like plants or something?
Humans. The emissary stared at me with his cold black eyes. Accurate representations of what the average dominant creatures are on this planet. They will be cared for quite kindly, and only dissected when they die. We are not cruel researchers. Now, I really didn't like the way this was going. These aliens wanted to take back some souvenirs, and if I wasn't careful, I was liable to be one. I took a step backward and turned to run, but found myself looking straight at the large, muscled chest of Pantagruel. He and the rest of the sideshow gang were blocking my exit.
So, Mr. Adagio said, pointing his Remington at me, I see you've wasted no time in trying to get P.T. Barnum's reward. You're so greedy, Reaper. That's your weakness.
I guess so, I said, but I always thought it was lack of foresight. I'm thinking of taking this bunch of Martians back to see P.T. Barnum and getting some of the reward money, but I don't think I'm going to go for the jackpot.
Jackpot? Mr. Adagio asked.
I smiled convincingly. You know, the mothership. There's supposed to be hundreds of Martians crawling around on that. It's the big one that fell from the sky. An enterprising feller with a few friends could capture them all, fly it back to P.T. Barnum and get enough reward money to become the next Vanderbilt.
I could see Mr. Adagio's black eyes get bigger.
Step aside, Reaper, he said. Let me follow the Martians back to their mothership. He stood up and locked arms with the lead alien. Lead on, my big-headed friend, he said.
Specimens, the emissary thought, and I could swear the edges of his tiny mouth turned up in a smile.
They're all yours, I told him. Mr. Adagio must have thought I was talking to him, because he frowned and pointed to little Napoleon.
You, guard him and the other ones until we get back with the mothership. Don't hesitate to shoot if they make a move on you.
It would be my pleasure, boss. Little Napoleon squeaked with joy. He stepped forward and gestured at me with his derringer.
Up against the wall, and the same with the mountain man, the greaser, and the German.
Trapper Jack, Hugo Montez, and Werner Humboldt like they were going to start a fight. But I shook my head and raised my hands, winking. I guess they figured it wasn't worth a brawl, because they followed Little Napoleon's orders without complaint. I guess Barnum was right, Mr. Adagio said with a laugh as he walked off with the aliens. There's a sucker born every minute. I reckon he was, I said, still raising my hands. I don't know if P.T. Barnum actually said that, but I was disinclined to put up any argument. Adagio and the Sideshow Gang disappeared into the desert, and after they were just tiny specks on the horizon, the three ruffians and I made our move. Jack took a step towards Little Napoleon, causing him to wave his little gun around and shriek. Then Hugo Montez took him from behind. When the dust settled, we had tied up the pipsqueak and were wondering what to do with him. I say we cut him into strips and roast him like bacon, Hugo Montez said, cleaning his teeth with his machete, or maybe the other way around. We could always use him as bait, Trapper Jack suggested. But it was Charles Green who had the best idea. He was digging around the Sideshow Gang's trailer and came out holding Trapper Jack's cactus costume. Hey, look at this, he piped. We can dress him up as a cactus. Or a Martian. Montez, Jack, Humboldt, and I said at the same time, I guess great or greedy minds think alike. In the background, there was a great rumble, and a huge, round mountain of metal flew into the air. It was as big as a city, and covered in blinking neon lights like a second sun. I couldn't help taking off my hat and letting out an odd, son of a gun, as it went up and up until it was just a speck in the sky. We rode the Sideshow Gang's bicycle contraption back to Santa Fe and found P.T. Barnum excitedly waiting for us. When we showed him the hog-tied form of Little Napoleon, trussed up in the green cactus costume, he nearly burst his britches with joy. We all split the money and then headed in separate directions. Barnum was a smart man, and I gave him about a week before I found out his Martian weren't nothing more than a midget in a costume. By that time, I would be halfway to California, far out of reach of Barnum or any agent he could hire. Hugo Montez planned to head south for Mexico, Trapper Jack north to Canada, and Werner von Humboldt east to the big cities. P.T. Barnum would have to split his efforts to track us four ways. As I plop myself down the train, my wound from the battle dressed in bandage, and my aching body nearly back to normal, I wondered aloud if we would ever see those undertakers again. I think so, Charles said. They seem like they could hold a grudge. That they do, I said. I flipped through a few telegrams that are waiting for me when I came to Santa Fe. Somebody in Kansas was having vampire problems. Some Americans are having a range war with a rancho in California. And there are rumors of prehistoric creatures in an Arizona canyon. All of those happenings would mean a job opening for a feller like me, and I still need work that paid. But for now, I put my hat over my face, closed my eyes, and took a well-deserved rest. I had a feeling I would need every second of it.
Well, that's the Showdown at Roswell. I do hope you enjoyed it. And remember to check out Clark Reaper Tales at Amazon.com. And visit ClarkReaper.com for more Clark Reaper-related news and other items of interest around the internet. Next week, we'll see what happens when Clark Reaper and Charles Green visit a demon-haunted mission in California. Thank you, and happy trails.